As a lot of you know, I moved to Utah a couple of years ago, and it's a super dry state. I do a lot of mountain biking, hiking, and skiing, and when I do those activities in this dry of a climate, it's crucial to avoid getting dehydrated, and that's where Element comes in. What a lot of people don't realize is that healthy hydration isn't just about drinking water, it's about replacing water and electrolytes, which makes sense because you lose both water and sodium when you sweat. So both need to be replaced to prevent muscle cramps, headaches, and energy dips. Unfortunately, the typical solutions on the market, Gatorade, other sports drinks, and low-quality electrolyte packs, are often loaded with sugar and a lot of artificial colors and flavors. This is why I've become a huge fan of Element. Element is a zero-sugar electrolyte solution for people who want to stay hydrated but don't want to put a lot of junk in their bodies. It comes in super convenient individual packs that you just mix into your water bottle and you're good to go. No sugar or artificial junk, just electrolytes and great taste. Element was formulated by my good friend and former research biochemist Rob Wolf to provide the optimal ratios of sodium, potassium, and magnesium for health, performance, and energy. They also did a great job with the flavors. My favorites are orange salt and watermelon salt. But they have several other great flavors that are worth trying too. I've turned most of my friends and family onto Element and they love it, so I wanted to give you the chance to try it too. For a limited time, the folks at Element are offering a free Element sample pack, which comes with 8 packets of Element, one of each flavor they sell. All you have to do is cover the cost of shipping, which is $5 for US customers and location dependent for international customers. Element has been an absolute game changer for me and so many people I know. I put one in my water bottle virtually every day and never exercise or do anything active without it. I hope you get as much benefit from it as I do. Just go to drinkelement.com/cresser. That's drinkelement.com/cresser to claim your free Element sample pack. You only cover the cost of shipping. Again, that's drinkelement.com/cresser. drinkelement.com/cresser. Hey everybody, Chris Cresser here. Welcome to another episode of Revolution Health Radio. This week, I am doing a solo episode on osteoporosis. I can't believe I've never done a full show on osteoporosis in 11 years of podcasting. I've covered it briefly in the context of other topics or maybe as a Q&A kind of grab bag type of thing, but I've never done a full show. And so I'm going to fix that issue here. So we're going to cover just some basics on bone remodeling and osteoporosis. We're going to talk about dietary considerations, including calcium, vitamins A, D, and K2, and magnesium. We're going to talk about gluten intolerance and how that can contribute. Talk about inflammation, both acute and chronic inflammation, and the impact that can have on osteoporosis risk. We're going to talk about dairy products and what role they should play in the diet. There's a lot of controversy about dairy and osteoporosis, so we're going to address that a little bit. We'll talk about collagen, which is a very important nutrient when it comes to bone health. We'll talk about acid alkaline balance and whether that's something you need to consider or be aware of in any way. And then exercise, sleep, and stress, which are all crucial factors, but often completely left out of the conversation. So I think you're going to get a lot out of this. And these are some excellent fundamental steps to take to both to prevent osteoporosis and even reverse it if it's already starting to develop. So hope you enjoy the show. Let's dive in. All right, so let's dive into this topic of osteoporosis. About 1 in 2 women and up to 1 in 4 men age 50 or older will break a bone due to osteoporosis. And it's not just about breaking the bone, because as I'm sure many of you know, fractures are one of the most serious things that can happen to us as we age, particularly people who are, let's say, 70 years old. There's a sip and a saying in medicine: break your hip, die of pneumonia. Because what can happen with a serious fracture is the patient becomes, immobilized and bedridden, and then, fluid can pool in the lungs in a hospital, and they can develop pneumonia, and then they can die from that. So, this is one of the many reasons why keeping our bones healthy as we age is super important. It's one of the things that impacts longevity more than just about anything else. The studies have shown that fractures can significantly increase the risk of early death for older adults, even doubling or tripling a risk of death in that age group. So it's a really important issue to be aware of. And if you see osteoporosis or, you know, earlier osteopenia starting to develop, it, you know, makes a lot of sense to address it. And of course, we want to do everything we can to prevent it from developing in the first place. So before we jump into the pathological processes of osteopenia, osteomalacia, and osteoporosis, we should talk a little bit about bones and the bone remodeling process, which is just the normal function of bone and how things should be working with bone. So as children's bones grow, the remodeling process is what allows those bones to get longer and to change shape and fit the needs of the body as it develops. And when new forces and stresses are applied to bone, remodeling is used to add new bone tissue to the area where it's needed based on these new movements and stresses, and then, you know, strengthen the bones and help them to be able to support the infrastructure of the body, if you will, as we grow. Another major function of bone is it's the biggest storage organ for calcium, which is kept in a really tight homeostatic range in our blood so that it can provide support for nerve signaling, blood clotting, muscle contractions, and many other functions that calcium helps with. When our blood levels of calcium drop, cells called osteoclasts break down bone tissue and release that calcium in the blood. Conversely, when calcium is elevated, as long as the body's healthy, it will use those osteoblasts to return that calcium to the bone reservoir. So it's a very dynamic process that's constantly in flux depending on the changing conditions. And if everything is working well, then the bones are healthy and retain their density and structure. So when things don't work well is, you know, one circumstance is just getting older. In that situation, that bone remodeling process becomes less efficient and osteopenia or osteoporosis can develop. So when that happens, it means the bones become more porous and thus a little more brittle. And this is typically diagnosed using bone mineral density scan with a DEXA machine. And, you know, typically will start, it's more common in women than men, typically starts to show up in the 50s, although it can start earlier, you know, like I've seen it in the late 30s and 40s. And of course, for some, it never happens at all. So it just depends on a number of different factors, both genetic and environmental, some of which we'll cover here. Osteomalacia is a little bit different. It's a softening of the bones due to vitamin D deficiency. And it is another cause, along with osteopenia and osteoporosis, of bone fractures. But this one has a much more direct traceable cause with vitamin D deficiency. So one other thing to be aware of is one of the reasons that women are at a significantly higher risk of osteopenia and osteoporosis is due to the role that estrogen plays in maintaining bone mass. And estrogen, of course, declines with age, and particularly when a woman enters menopause and estrogen levels go down, then that supportive role that estrogen was playing in bone mass decreases. So we're not going to talk a lot about estrogen and estrogen metabolism and regulation in this show, but that is something that you should definitely be aware of. And there are hormonal considerations when it comes to osteoporosis. I'm going to focus on a lot of the other considerations in this show because they're more broadly applicable. But, you know, if you try a lot of the things that I talk about in this show and you're not getting good results, then one further step to take would be consulting with a functional medicine practitioner that understands hormones and hormone balance, particularly in menopausal women, and making sure that's all working as it should be, because that can definitely be an important factor. Okay, so let's start by talking a little bit about calcium that always comes up in discussions of bone health, and it is an important nutrient. As I mentioned, the bone is one of the main functions is it's a storage reservoir for calcium. And so this should always be at the top of the list when you're thinking about bone health. However, I would say that it's sometimes too much focus is put here at the expense of other important factors. And calcium supplementation is problematic, as we'll discuss a little bit, and is often done poorly and in a way that actually not only doesn't improve bone health, but may even increase the risk of fractures. So let's just start with what you should be doing in terms of calcium. Then we'll talk a little bit about supplementation and some of the considerations there if you're not getting enough calcium through diet. So even the range, the ideal range for calcium is somewhat controversial. If, you know, conventional sources will recommend anywhere from 1,000 to 1,300 milligrams daily for adults, with women who are pregnant or nursing or trying to conceive being on, and also women above 55, 60 years of age at the higher end of that range, 1,300 milligrams. And, you know, younger women and men being at the around 1,000 milligram part of the range. Some sources, though, suggest that we really only need about 600 to 800 milligrams of calcium, as long as you're getting adequate amounts of other synergistic nutrients like vitamin K2, vitamin A, and vitamin D. So it's a little bit unclear. I tend to probably fall more in the latter camp, because I think nutrient synergy is a really important concept that, and it's not unusual in the case of many other nutrients that if you get enough of all of the synergistic nutrients, the amount that you need of the one target nutrient drops. I think that's a pretty well-established concept in biology, biochemistry, and when it applies to the human body and nutrient status. And then there are others who argue that the bioavailability of calcium from different foods will affect how much calcium you actually need to eat in order to get the full calcium needs met daily. And I'm definitely one of those people, because we know that bioavailability can vary dramatically. For example, some animal sources of calcium like fish bones and dairy products are highly bioavailable. Also, cruciferous vegetables like broccoli tend to be very bioavailable. But calcium, as it occurs in dark leafy greens like collard greens and spinach, is not very bioavailable. Not very bioavailable because of the phytic acid that's in those foods. Phytic acid is a compound that inhibits calcium absorption, and it's found in relatively high amounts in dark leafy greens like collards and spinach. So if you look at a chart with highest food sources of calcium, foods like sesame seeds, that's actually number one in terms of serving size. Sardines with bones is number two. Yogurt is number three. And then collard greens and spinach are number four and five. But of those top five, sesame seeds, collard greens, and spinach are going to be much more poorly absorbed than the calcium from sardines with bones and yogurt. So even though on paper they appear, you know, in that top five list, you're going to be able to absorb the calcium in dairy and the sardine bones much more readily than you will with those other foods. Broccoli is down around number 15, just below kale and cabbage, and chard, but it would actually probably be higher than kale and cabbage and chard for the reasons that I just mentioned. So just keep that in mind when you're looking at lists that document the amount of calcium in foods. Almost none of those lists consider bioavailability as a factor, and it's really important to do that. So vitamins D, A, and K2 play a synergistic role with calcium, and I'm going to come back to those in a moment. But as I was saying before, if you need to make sure that you're getting enough of those nutrients as well. If you are, I think targeting, you know, for let's say a menopausal woman, targeting a range of 800 milligrams of calcium a day while making sure that you get enough of those other synergistic nutrients is probably a good target. And you can do that without eating dairy. It's harder. But if you're eating like bone-in fish, like canned fish, like sardines with bone, the bones are soft. You can easily eat them. Canned sockeye salmon with bones is a great source. That's like number 7 or 8 on the list. So if you eat a few of those a week, and then you're eating plenty of greens and cruciferous vegetables, sesame seeds, things like that, then you should be able to meet your daily calcium need fairly easily. If you are able to tolerate dairy like yogurt and kefir and cheese, that will make it even easier because that's highly bioavailable source of calcium, and it's also at the top of the list in terms of the amount of calcium in foods. Several of the top 10 foods are dairy foods. That's easier for sure. So let's talk a little bit about calcium supplementation. So if you look at your calcium intake, you use kind of any of the many online tools available for measuring your daily intake of calcium, and you determine that you're below that range, which is not unusual, then you have to start thinking about calcium supplements. So calcium supplements are among the most commonly sold supplements. And calcium's in almost all the multivitamins, and then there are lots of calcium supplements that are sold, particularly to older adults. However, the research on the impact of these calcium supplements is pretty disappointing, to say the least. So, for example, a 2012 analysis found that consuming calcium in the form of supplements provided no benefit for hip or lumbar vertebral bone mineral density in older adults. A 2007 study published in the American Journal of Clinical Nutrition found that calcium supplements don't reduce fracture rates in postmenopausal women and may actually even increase the rate of hip fractures. So this is what I was talking about before. Beyond that, calcium supplementation has been shown to have some pretty disturbing risks associated with it. So a 2012 study of 24,000 men and women aged 35 to 64, published in BMJ, found that those who used calcium supplements had almost 140% greater risk of heart attack during the 11-year study period, while intake of food calcium did not increase the risk. So I'm going to come back to that. It's a really important point. A meta-analysis of studies involving more than 12,000 people, also published in the BMJ, found that calcium supplementation increased the risk of heart attack by 31%, stroke by 20%, and deaths from all causes by 9%. Then there was another analysis involving 12,000 men, published in JAMA Internal Medicine, which found that intakes of over 1,000 milligrams a day of supplemental calcium were associated with 20% increase in the risk of death from cardiovascular disease. So that's just for heart disease risk. There's also cancer, kidney stones, and other health risks associated with excess calcium intake. And I wrote an article about this. We'll put a link to it in the show notes. And if you just search for Chris Kresser calcium supplements, it'll pop right up. There's a lot more data there, and think, I highly recommend reading that if you're interested in this topic. Just now, I mentioned that in one of these studies, actually in many of these studies, they see a distinct difference between the impact of supplemental calcium and food calcium. So, in other words, eating more calcium from food does not have the same impact and is not associated with the same risks as increasing your calcium from supplements. Why would that be? Well, one theory is that when you take supplemental calcium, you're taking it in a kind of unnatural way, where you're taking a large bolus of calcium that is absorbed rapidly into the bloodstream. And then the body doesn't really know what to do with that calcium, and it ends up getting into the soft tissues, like the arteries or the heart, where it does not belong, or the kidneys, and it causes those problems like increasing cardiovascular disease and increasing kidney stones. Whereas when you eat calcium in food, it's bound with the food and it's absorbed much more slowly. And that's, the typical way that we ate calcium historically as human beings. And so the body knows how to process that and deal with that. And the calcium ends up in the bones and the hard tissues where it belongs. Now, another factor that determines where calcium ends up is if you have adequate levels of K2 and D, because those regulate calcium metabolism. And so that could be another kind of risk factor. If you're taking typical calcium supplements and you're low in K2, K2 makes sure that calcium gets into the bones and the teeth and the hard tissues where it belongs and stays out of the soft tissues where it doesn't belong. So if you have low K2, it's even more likely that you might be harmed by calcium supplementation. So what to do about all this? Well, the only form of calcium that I feel really confident in that doesn't cause this problem is whole bone meal. So this is calcium that is basically you're taking bone meal, and bone, of course, has calcium. I said before, that's one of its major functions, is being the reservoir of calcium. So if you take a bone meal complex, they will not only contain calcium, but it'll also contain other good things that are found in bone, like collagen, growth factors, trace minerals, and other elements that we need. And that's actually the way that humans probably got most of our calcium for the vast majority of our evolutionary history, because, you know, we only started consuming dairy products regularly maybe 11,000 years ago. And even then, only in some parts of the world. Still many parts of the world, most people don't consume dairy products, but they still get enough calcium. So they could get that, you know, in a Paleolithic diet from gnawing on bones and actually eating some bones. Later on, eating bones with fish in them, you know, fermenting the fish and the bones, making the bones soft. And then, of course, through some of the vegetables, greens, seeds, cruciferous vegetables, et cetera, probably more recently. So whole bone meal is the best form of calcium supplement to take. Unfortunately, it's not pleasant for most people. It's a grit, as you can imagine, it's kind of a gritty texture and, you know, not as easy to take as typical, you know, calcium supplements that you might buy at the local drugstore or something like that. But I think it's worth it because it's a much safer form of calcium to supplement with. There are a few different brands out there now that offer bones from free range and pasture fed animals. And so, you know, I don't necessarily have a particular brand that I recommend, but I would search for bone meal complex from free range pasture fed animals, ideally. Okay, so that's calcium. And I want to move on to talk a little bit about vitamins A, D, and K, which are the other fat soluble vitamins that play a synergistic role with calcium and help with calcium metabolism. I don't want to spend too much time on this because there's a lot more I want to cover. But in short, like I said, K2 regulates calcium metabolism, helps it get into the hard tissues where it belongs and stay out of the soft tissues where it doesn't belong. And K2, I've written a bunch of that on this. So if you just search for Chris Kresser, K2, you can get some, you know, basic info on how to get it into your diet. It's found in dark meat, chicken, goose liver, which I bet all of you are eating on a regular basis. It's in fermented foods like natto. Again, not a very commonly eaten food, but it's also in hard cheeses. It's in like fermented foods like sauerkraut and kefir. So a little tricky to get through the diet. These days, certain vitamin D supplements, you can get combo vitamin D, K2 supplements. Now has a good supplement that has vitamin D and K2 in it. And there's also a great book by Dr. Kate Rumbleu, Vitamin K2 and the Calcium Paradox, which we'll try to link to in the show notes if you want to get a little bit more information about the relationship between K2 and calcium. Vitamin D also plays a role in calcium metabolism. And this is, of course, a nutrient that is often low in many people. So making sure you're maintaining normal vitamin D levels. I recommend a range now. You know, this is during the COVID pandemic. I'm recording this about 18, 20 months in, and I recommend a range of 40 to 60 or even 50 to 60 nanograms per milliliter in the time of this pandemic. And I would, you know, 40 to 60 would be a pretty good range to shoot for in general. And then finally, vitamin A doesn't play as much of a role in calcium metabolism as vitamins D and K2, but it does play a role. And so, you know, getting enough vitamin A from liver, organ meats, you know, cod liver oil, things like egg yolks, pasture-raised butter, et cetera, can be good sources of vitamin A. Okay, so let's move on to magnesium, another critical nutrient for bone health, but not often talked about in the conventional world, at least in that context. Magnesium is one of the key minerals that makes up the structure of the bone matrix, and it can be pulled out of the bones if blood magnesium levels drop. And magnesium levels are typically low. It's one of the nutrients that is most commonly shows up as low when we do nutrient testing on patients. And I can't remember the exact percentage of Americans that are low on magnesium, but it's the majority. It's definitely over 50%. And then, you know, magnesium deficiency, not surprisingly, given what I just said, is a known risk factor for osteoporosis. So I recommend a range of magnesium of, you know, around 800 milligrams a day, and that can come from food and supplements. So a lot of people do need to supplement with magnesium, and somewhere between 200 to 400 milligrams per day of supplementation is often a good idea in order to maintain normal magnesium levels. So the best forms of magnesium to supplement with are glycinate and malate, which are generally better tolerated and better absorbed than like citrate or oxide, and don't tend to cause as many digestive side effects. So, you know, that's typically the best way to supplement with magnesium. There are lots of different brands out there that offer glycinate and malate. Another thing to consider with osteoporosis, and again, something that's not typically thought of in the conventional approach to it, is inflammation. So there are several different inflammatory cytokines that have been implicated in the development of osteoporosis, and chronic inflammation is believed to be a major risk factor for the disease. So it's beyond the scope of this podcast to go into every potential cause of inflammation, but it's just something to be aware of. If you're dealing with osteoporosis, you definitely, of course, want to be on an anti-inflammatory diet, because diet is one of the biggest sources of inflammation. You know, nutrient-dense whole foods, anti-inflammatory diet, eating plenty of EPA and DHA, which are the long-chain omega-3 fats, which are anti-inflammatory, reducing your intake of industrial seed oils that are high in omega-6 and tend to be inflammatory, reducing your consumption of flour and sugar, but then also identifying other potential sources of inflammation like undetected gut infection or SIBO or heavy metal toxicity, other toxins, et cetera. So that's really important. Gluten is another issue that can potentially contribute to osteoporosis. So I just mentioned that inflammation is a significant risk factor. And if someone is gluten intolerant and is not aware of that, and they're eating gluten-containing foods on a regular basis, then that's going to basically cause a persistent state of low-grade chronic inflammation, which could increase the risk of osteoporosis. And some of the lines of evidence that support this are the observation that a decrease in bone density is one of the first symptoms of celiac disease, even in otherwise asymptomatic patients. That's been documented in the literature. And the good news, on the other hand, is that those who have reduced bone mineral density from previously undiagnosed and untreated celiac disease can significantly improve their bone strength, followed by a gluten-free diet. A couple studies have shown that to be true. So if you are gluten intolerant and you learn that and you take it out of your diet, then the bone density can actually improve just from that single change. So really important factor to consider. Dairy products. So another very controversial topic. I've written a separate article on dairy products and osteoporosis. So again, we'll put in the show notes, and you can just search for Chris Kresser dairy osteoporosis. And there's a lot of myth busting in that article because, you know, this is actually one area where I agree with the conventional nutrition paradigm, because the conventional nutrition paradigm has at least, you know, mostly been very supportive of dairy products as a way of preventing and improving osteoporosis. Whereas in the integrative medicine world, I think there's been more of a bias against dairy products as being inflammatory, which they certainly can be for some people who are intolerant of the proteins or the sugar, but they aren't necessarily inflammatory for people who are not intolerant. And they have a lot of beneficial nutrients, calcium being one of the main, you know, highly bioavailable calcium, and they can really be a helpful addition to the diet in certain cases. So dairy products, as I mentioned before, are very high rich sources of calcium. They're bioavailable. And while you don't need them necessarily to get adequate calcium and vitamin D to build healthy bones, certainly it's easier if you tolerate, you know, full fat kefir or yogurt and some, you know, some hard cheeses. Even you can generally, even people who are lactose sensitive can tolerate some amount of those more, you know, full fat and more fermented dairy because they're much lower in lactose, but they still contain good amounts of calcium and other beneficial nutrients. So just including some yogurt or kefir daily and some hard cheese is a really good way of boosting calcium intake if you don't have any issue with dairy products. Next is collagen. So collagen, about 25 to 30% of the dry weight of bone is made of collagen protein. And the strength of our bones is highly dependent on the quality of the collagen matrix, and especially the cross-linking of collagen. So it makes sense that supporting collagen formation is a really important component of keeping bones strong as we age. In order to do that, you have to have the amino acids glycine, proline, and lysine, along with adequate amounts of vitamin C that's needed for the hydroxylation of those amino acids and the production of collagen. The body can produce some of its own glycine, proline, and lysine from dietary protein. There's some evidence that that doesn't happen very well, and it's really much better to get them from foods and in the diet. So that means eating lots of bones, joints, tendons, and skin from other animals. And this is one of the reasons why I've been such an advocate of bone broth for many, many years, consuming gelatin. So this is like eating the odd bits of the animal, nose to tail, eating pattern that our ancestors would have done. And they didn't know the science behind it, but this is certainly one of the ways that they benefited from doing that. Instead of just eating, like, you know, very lean steak or lean ground beef, consuming, you know, some of these other parts of the animal, or even just fattier, more gelatinous cuts of meat like brisket, chuck roast, oxtail, shanks, et cetera, will help increase your gelatin consumption. And then getting plenty of vitamin C from fresh fruits and vegetables to help ensure proper collagen formation. That's all really important and can contribute to bone health. Some of you are probably wondering about acid alkaline balance, and particularly in relation to dietary protein and things like dairy products and the effect on bone health. There's a kind of a common critique of the paleo diet, which is that it causes acidification of the body because it's so high in animal protein, and that leads to bone demineralization. But that's just simply incorrect. I wrote a series on acid alkaline myth. There's two articles. Again, we'll try to link to that in the show notes, and just, or just search for Chris Kresser acid alkaline myth. And I just deconstruct that entire argument using a lot of studies and research, and showing that that argument is fundamentally flawed on many levels. And of course, we also have observational studies that have not found a correlation between dietary acid load and bone mineral density. And in fact, animal protein, which is the most acid-forming food of all, has been associated with better bone health in numerous observational studies. So it's just an argument that doesn't really carry any legitimate weight, in at least according to the scientific literature. And it shouldn't be a concern if you're, you know, consuming animal proteins and wanting to strengthen your bones, then animal protein and dairy products will be very helpful. Exercise is critical, and particularly weight-bearing exercise. That's what's most important for improving bone density. And, you know, strength training in particular with relatively heavy weights is important. Obviously, you don't want to start there if you haven't been doing any strength training at all. And it's not necessary. You don't necessarily ever have to get to really heavy weights. But the stress that weight-bearing exercise puts on the bones really stimulates the remodeling process that we talked about in the beginning of this show. And just doing moderate weightlifting exercises a few times a week, for example, has been shown to significantly increase bone density, particularly in postmenopausal women. One of the things I tell my patients, both men and women, but especially women who are in their, you know, 40s and 50s, is like lifting weights is really one of the best things you can do for to promote your longevity. Not just because of the kind of overall pleiotropic benefits of exercise, but like I said, this weight-bearing exercise in particular strengthens our bones. It also, of course, strengthens our muscle and increases muscle mass. And I think maintaining adequate muscle mass and adequate bone density are really two of the most important things we can do to expand our health span as we age. So really critical for bone density and health, and something that I see a lot of people omit from their, you know, physical activity regimen. You won't be surprised to hear me say that sleep is critical for bone health. Melatonin affects the actions of osteoblasts and osteoclasts and interacts with other hormones like estrogen to augment bone remodeling. And it also functions as a really potent antioxidant, which protects bone cells from oxidative stress and inflammation. The best way to keep melatonin production functioning optimally is to entrain your circadian rhythms to the appropriate 24-hour cycle, which means limiting your exposure to artificial light at night, getting some exposure to bright sunlight during the day, committing to 8 hours, you know, 7 to 8 hours at least of quality sleep in a cool, dark room. All of that will help boost melatonin production. And so, you know, following good sleep hygiene methods and doing everything that I just said will, sleep helps with so many different things, but in, particularly in relation to bone health, it's critical. Stress is another factor for that almost always gets ignored in the conventional paradigm. But stress can have a big impact on bone health. We know that long-term use of corticosteroid medications, which affect cortisol levels, cause bone loss and can lead to osteoporosis. So, you know, depressing cortisol really, really low does that. On the flip side, really high cortisol persistently can have similar effects on bone density. Cortisol indirectly acts on bone by blocking calcium absorption, and that decreases bone cell growth. And so some studies have shown that even a short bout of high cortisol can cause a decrease in bone mass, and that prolonged high cortisol can lead to decreases in bone density. So another important consideration, you know, lots of different options for managing stress and cortisol levels, including meditation, mindfulness, deep breathing, yoga, social support. There are lots of new, you know, PEMF, infrared sauna, things like that that can help. But just having a regular stress management practice is essential. You know, I'm probably preaching the choir here. I don't know if it's necessary to mention this, but I should at least. Tobacco, you know, smoking cigarettes and excess alcohol consumption are definitely linked to reduced bone density. So if you're smoking or drinking a lot, then addressing those two things would be right at the top of the list, along with everything else that we've covered in the show so far. So those are kind of my fundamental recommendations for osteoporosis that anyone can do without any lab testing or access to a functional medicine provider. I think those are all, you know, this is an excellent starting place. And I would try this and do this for a period of time And then if you're not getting results, then you can move on to the next steps, which get a little bit more complicated, might involve working with a practitioner and getting some testing. I mentioned earlier, estrogen is really critical for women, particularly women in menopause or perimenopause. So taking a closer look at that would be good. And then, you know, supplementing with a higher dose of K2 is something that you could consider even without seeing a practitioner. The typical range that's, you know, supplement range that's recommended is in the microgram quantity, like 100 to 300 micrograms a day. But in some of the Japanese osteoporosis studies, they use doses as high as 30 to 40 milligrams, and they use those for an extended period of time with no ill effects. Vitamin K2 seems to be one of the nutrients that doesn't have an upper limit that we know of yet. It doesn't seem to be a known toxicity range. So I'm quite comfortable recommending doses up to, you know, 10, 20 milligrams per day for my patients of vitamin K2 who are already dealing with osteoporosis to help, you know, redirect that calcium into the bone and help remineralize the bone. There are a bunch of other things that a functional medicine practitioner might start to look at, including underlying causes of inflammation, which I mentioned before, that things like gut infections, heavy metals, and other toxins, and you know, just doing a deeper dive into some of the underlying factors that can drive osteoporosis. Okay, so I hope that was really helpful. And please do keep sending in your questions to chriscresser.com/podcast question. And I will talk to you next time. That's the end of this episode of Revolution Health Radio. If you appreciate the show and want to help me create a healthier and happier world, please head over to iTunes and leave us a review. They really do make a difference. If you'd like to ask a question for me to answer on a future episode, you can do that at chriscresser.com/podcast question. You can also leave a suggestion for someone you'd like me to interview there. If you're on social media, you can follow me at twitter.com/chriscresser or facebook.com/chriscresserlac. I post a lot of articles and research that I do throughout the week there that never makes it to the blog or podcast, so it's a great way to stay abreast of the latest developments. Thanks so much for listening. Talk to you next time.